You are listening to The World Cafe. Hey, I'm Kaleo. We're bringing you something special this week on our podcast. It's Carnival, Haitian Rhythms and the Music of New Orleans. It's a four-part audio documentary that chronicles the history of Haiti and explores that nation's influence on the music, culture, and identity of the Crescent City, New Orleans. The documentary was produced by WXPN, where we make World Cafe, and it's hosted by Layla McCalla, a Haitian-American musician and songwriter based in New Orleans. You might know her from her work with the Carolina Chocolate Drops or Our Native Daughters. She's also been a guest on the cafe in the past, so we're thrilled that she's here to present this documentary. Anyway, I'll hand it over to Layla. Here's episode one of Carnival, Haitian Rhythms and the Music of New Orleans. Enjoy.
You're listening to Carnival, Haitian Rhythms and the Music of New Orleans. I'm Layla McCalla. I'll never forget going to Cap Haïtien for the first time. It's a beautiful coastal city in the north of Haiti, where colorful facades feature arched doors and overhanging balconies. I remember thinking, this looks like the French Quarter. Or wait a minute, does the French Quarter look like Cap Haïtien? As a Haitian American who lives in New Orleans, I often sense these moments of recognition. The sound of a drum or horn. The aroma from a kitchen. The look of the food. A house I stumble upon reminds me of one place or the other. There are also more subtle ways of being. The way the people in both places are open to celebrating. We've elevated hanging out to a high art. The way Haitians and New Orleanians share a strong spiritual connection to the place they're from and the place they live in. I was born in Queens, New York in 1985. My parents immigrated to the U.S. in the 1960s during the violent and tyrannical Papa Doc Duvalier regime. My parents became activists and have been involved in the movement for Haitian human rights in the U.S. and in Haiti for my entire life. Through them, I learned about Haitian culture and language. But it wasn't until I moved to New Orleans in my 20s that I realized that Creole is more than a language. It's an identity. It carries a unique history that we should all know more about. I've become passionate about finding ways to share the beauty and connections I find between the cultures of my ancestral and adopted homes. Down by the riverside, I hear the babies crying. And in the morning, I hear the mama singing. My work as a songwriter, cellist, and singer explores these historic and sonic connections between the places I love. Haiti and New Orleans. And in the evening, I hear the mama singing. Ooh. One step, two step, three step, move. Everybody else has got something to prove except me and my baby. It's just me. Whether it's weaving together the poems of Langston Hughes with Haitian folk songs. Merci bon Dieu, car et tout ça la nature. Or bringing musicians from Haiti and New Orleans together in one room to play. Settle down to keep your feet on the ground. Settle down to keep your feet on the ground. Or writing my own songs to sing in Haitian Creole. Something feels like home in all of this music. It's why those buildings in Cap Haïtien reminded me of the French Quarter. They share a deep cultural history that spans hundreds of years. That history is evident in so much of what we cherish in New Orleans, and it's especially ingrained in the DNA of the music. Yet many people only associate Haiti with the disaster stories the media tell again and again. Stereotypes that frame it as an irreversibly damaged place.
Excellence, mesdames et messieurs,
the United States occupied Haiti from 1915 to 1934 after its president was lynched in a coup d'état. Later, François Papadoc Duvalier and his son Jean-Claude held power for nearly 30 years.
Je dois vous dire, en toute franchise, que il n'a jamais été question pour nous.
A violent, chaotic dictatorship that a popular uprising brought down. After the installation of an interim military government, the first democratically elected president of Haiti, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, followed the Duvaliers. Despite this victory for democracy, the early 90s were a very tumultuous time in Haiti. In part because the U.S. intervened, Aristide went into exile twice. Corruption and repression mar his complicated legacy.
We are hearing these descriptions of the disaster in Haiti after yesterday's earthquake. Catastrophe, horrific, unbelievable, devastating.
A catastrophic earthquake in 2010 killed hundreds of thousands of people and displaced millions more.
Much needed food is being brought into the south of Haiti. Many communities are becoming increasingly desperate. Electricity cut off, water and food are scarce.
Even though the country struggles with systemic poverty and hunger, there are so many other stories to tell. There's so much gorgeous and vibrant expression that comes from Haiti. The fact is, other countries have deliberately held back Haiti's development since its inception. It's possible to trace all of Haiti's major challenges to its colonial history. Let's go back to before Haiti was Haiti, to when it was a French colony, perhaps the most profitable land on the planet because of what enslaved people made there, sugar. Before Haiti was Haiti, it was a French colony called Saint-Domingue.
Saint-Domingue was this powerhouse of the Atlantic economy. You know, it was like massively productive in terms of sugar and coffee and wealth.
It was a very fertile and fecund place.
Saint-Domingue was so profitable. The income from Saint-Domingue allowed for the growth of a bourgeoisie that could revolt in the French Revolution.
This wealth came, in large part, from sugarcane plantations. The process of turning cane into sugar was anything but sweet.
It's a particularly brutal crop to bring in. When you're in the harvest season, it has to be harvested very, very quickly or it goes bad very quickly. And so that led to basically a 24-hour cycle of cutting it and then grinding it and then boiling the juice and crystallizing the sugar.
Angel Parham teaches history at Loyola University in New Orleans. Her book, American Roots, examines the migration to New Orleans of people fleeing revolution in Saint-Domingue. That revolution had everything to do with making sugar.
Enslaved people would have to do their regular shift during the day, and then they had a double shift at night.
This was brutal.
Because it was such a lucrative crop, it made so much money for the owners that kind of the approach to slavery that the French took was to work their slaves to death, literally squeeze as much work and life out of them as they could as quickly as possible. And when they die, just buy some new people.
The planters just calculated and understood that oftentimes people would only live 3, 4, 5 years, that very few children would be born, and that the model was essentially just buying more people from the slave trade. That was the economic model.
Laurent Dubois teaches history at Duke University. He's written extensively about the history of Haiti. Dubois says enslaved people were constantly thrown together, snatched from their homes in West and Central Africa, speaking different languages and coming from a range of cultures. They were forced into close proximity.
In Saint-Domingue, they were jammed together in the confines of a labor camp.
Writer and musician Ned Sublette. He's the author of The World That Made New Orleans.
No piece of ground in Africa had sustained that dense a population ever, with that many people in close contact from so many different places, learning to work together under military discipline.
This Africanness of the population is important.
Laurent Dubois.
At the time of Haitian independence, there's really a lot of people who had been enslaved maybe for like 3 to 4 years in their lives, you know? They had grown up, say, in Central Africa or West Africa, survivors of the Middle Passage. They arrive in this plantation world.
A plantation world that wasn't just brutal, systemically, often sadistically brutal. In the late 1700s, it was alive with revolutionary ideas influenced by philosophers like Voltaire and Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Everyone in Saint-Domingue was talking about what was going on in France, a revolution.
Men are born and remain free and equal in rights.
Those words from the Declaration of the Rights of Man reverberated across the ocean, says Angel Parham.
There were colonists, white colonists, in the colony of Saint-Domingue, who also felt that, you know, we should have more autonomy. We're the ones actually living here. We're the ones generating this wealth. Why should we have to answer to what's going on in France?
These colonists were mostly French and white. They created a three-tiered society in Saint-Domingue, with themselves at the top. At the bottom were enslaved Africans, who outnumbered them by about 10 to 1. In between, in numbers about the same as the whites, was a mixture. Free people of color.
Free people of color generally had some ties to Europeans, to the French, often had French fathers who would have educated their sons in Paris, were often wealthy in their own rights, sometimes slave owners in their own rights.
Free people of color wanted political rights too, such as the right to vote. So did blacks. Talk of political rights and updates from France spread through the enslaved population by people who were privy to the news, coach drivers.
Coach drivers were able to go from plantation to plantation carrying the news to other enslaved people. And this idea of liberty, equality, and brotherhood sounded very good to enslaved people. You know, it sounded good to everyone.
People who were enslaved most certainly didn't buy the idea that they should be enslaved. You know, they obviously thought that this was essentially some kind of crazy, mad system that unfortunately they had found themselves in.
Dubois says some enslaved people knew how to fight their way out of it.
A lot of people who were enslaved were actually former soldiers. Many of them were captured in wars that had been accelerating in part because of the slave trade.
Captured in Central Africa and sold to European slavers.
Throughout the 1780s, the French were basically importing huge numbers of African veterans. People who had fought in wars before, people who had been using firearms, been fighting in Central Africa.
Again, Angel Parham.
So 1789, you get the beginning of the French Revolution, and just 2 years later, you get the beginning of the revolution in the colony of Saint-Domingue in August 1791.
Take brutal slave conditions. Minority rule forced onto a majority of the people, some of whom have military training, just as ideas about equality and rights are percolating. And what do you get? Ned Sublette says, revolution.
What we call the Haitian Revolution, this umbrella name, is really a series of struggles.
It began in 1791 when two groups, Maroons, who'd escaped enslavement and lived in the mountains, and enslaved people, still living on plantations and in cities, organized together. It's known as Boukman's Uprising, after an enslaved man named Dudi Boukman. Haitian writer Edwige Dantika tells us Dudi Boukman was born in Senegambia, Africa, where he was later captured and enslaved.
He was a Maroon, and a slave revolt, and he had gathered people together in one place in the ceremony in the woods, and made everyone pledge to live free or die.
Legend has it, alongside a voodoo priestess, Cécile Fatima, Boukman led a religious voodoo ceremony in Bois Caïman, infusing the Haitian Revolution with a spiritual foundation. they sacrificed a pig. Boukman and Fatima told the group of Maroons and enslaved people that the god of their oppressors had called for their blood. They must cast aside the image of the oppressor's god. Instead, they must listen to their gods and to the liberty beating in their hearts. They must change the situation. This ceremony sparked the Haitian Revolution into action.
Of course, in our history, there's always kind of the myth, and there's the history. And in the myth mix of history is that that night, all those people were there who eventually went on to actually do the actual fighting and were inspired by him.
That first uprising, energized by Dudi Boukman,
coordinated across a wide area in the north, takes the big sugar installations, destroys them, flattens them.
Without these slave labor camps, Sublette says, there would be no more sugar or coffee, no more wealth for the colonists.
Slave owners were terrified by this. This was the culmination of what had been feared all along. And now it seemed to be coming true, and indeed it was.
The revolution started in 1791. A dozen years later, it ended in a showdown with the most powerful fighting force of the time, the army of Napoleon Bonaparte.
Napoleon had thought he would reestablish plantation slavery in Saint-Domingue and Louisiana, and that the vast revenues from this would fund his military conquest of Europe.
And so,
Napoleon sent the largest military force that had crossed the Atlantic up to that point, headed by his brother-in-law, General Leclerc, to Saint-Domingue to subdue the Africans, these primitive people as Napoleon saw them. No one thought that the black people in Saint-Domingue could withstand the onslaught of Napoleon's mighty army.
But they did. Between yellow fever and the resistance, Napoleon's army lost spectacularly. In 1804, Haiti declared independence. Haiti abolished slavery and became the first independent black nation on earth. Without this incredibly profitable island, Dubois says Napoleon had no need for the land called the Louisiana Territory.
What Napoleon needed was a North American support colony for the Caribbean. Like, he needed a place to get wood and provisions and that kind of stuff. That was what essentially the plan was for Louisiana, was to successfully turn it into a kind of North American settler colony so that the Caribbean could be rebuilt to its former glory as a plantation society.
When Napoleon saw that he was not going to be able to retake Saint-Domingue, he spent no time at all, made a quick decision. The last thing he wanted was for the British to have it, and he offered it to Jefferson's men.
Who, Sublette says, bought it for $15 million, about 4 cents an acre. The Louisiana Purchase nearly doubled the size of the United States. Meanwhile, Haiti, the nation that made this possible,
immediately, Haiti became a pariah.
France refused to recognize the new nation. Also,
the United States was not about to recognize a successful slave revolution.
That would have been way too risky. The U.S. economy ran on slavery. Americans, in particular slave owners, were terrified that what happened in Haiti would spread like a contagion to the United States. Haiti's leaders were desperate for recognition so they could negotiate trade deals and bring in money. The country's presidents tried and tried. Finally, 21 years after independence, in 1825, President Jean-Pierre Boyer made a deal. France would recognize Haiti, and in exchange, Dubois says, Haiti would pay reparations.
Essentially to kind of compensate the planters who lost their property. The property, most of which was invested in human beings. People who had been enslaved or whose parents had been enslaved were paying money to their former owners because they had dared to be free.
You heard that right. People who were stolen from their homes and forced into brutal unpaid labor had to pay their former owners for their freedom. This arrangement was so unpopular in Haiti, President Boyer went behind his parliament's back, Sublette says, to make the deal.
The Haitians had to pay France millions of francs, which were borrowed from a bank and then repaid into the 20th century. Basically, they had to buy themselves back from the slave owners, which crippled Haiti's economy from the very beginning.
Laurent Dubois.
They were paying what's known as the double debt. They were paying interest on loans to pay the first debt throughout the 19th century. And this, at certain points, took up a huge portion of the Haitian treasury.
Many refused to trade with the fledgling nation. It took almost six decades and the Civil War before the United States officially recognized Haiti on June 5, 1862. But by then, Haiti had already transformed the United States.
That was a presentation of episode one of Carnival, Haitian Rhythms and the Music of New Orleans. Thanks so much to our host, Layla McCalla. Coming up in episode two, after the Haitian Revolution, more than 10,000 free and enslaved Haitians made their way to New Orleans. How did that massive migration change and influence the identity of the city? In what ways do we still see, feel, and hear those influences today?
In New Orleans, music and dancing was a way to transcend any kind of difficulties. And in Haiti, it was absolutely the same thing.
This episode of Carnival, Haitian Rhythms and the Music of New Orleans, was written and produced by Eve Abrams and Alex Lewis. For more stories, visit xpn.carnival.org. Carnival has been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. This project is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts on the web at arts.gov. Additional support from the Wincote Foundation. The executive producers are Roger LeMay and Bruce Warren, senior producer Alex Lewis, assistant producer Eve Abrams, editor Cheryl Duvall, mixing by Jeff Town, production assistant Sam Kessler. I'm Kaleo. Thanks so much for listening to The World Cafe.